Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Well, hello.
Here's John Williams.
Dolly. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio on WGN Radio. I'm here till 3 o'clock.
Lord have mercy.
We do a Saturday show, too, that's kind of on hiatus right now. Northwestern football preempts us a lot between 10 a.m. and noon on Saturdays. We'll get back in the saddle when the season is over. Until then, remember, you can also follow me on social media. I'm WGN King John there. You'll find my daily news click there, a web poll question that we ask you. We also post that on the WGN Radio Facebook page. I said hello, Dolly, because I went to the Chicago opening of that show with Betty Buckley as Dolly last night. Dean Richards is going to do the show for me tomorrow, and I'm sure he'll have more to say about that. Dean was there as well as producer Elif and several of us at WGN Radio. I don't know anything about Betty Buckley, and I know the story of Hello, Dolly, but not that well. Hadn't seen the movie in a while and wanted to see the show. And I thought that it was charming. And at the beginning of the second act, when she comes out and does that big signature song that everybody's waiting for, the waiters all dancing around and singing, and madcap craziness and fun is happening on the screen or stage, and you're all waiting for the big entrance at the top of the staircase where Dolly makes her appearance in a gorgeous dress and a hat. And then she comes down in the whole chorus and she sings Hello, Dolly. And it's really, really fun. And she's 70-something years old. And I just thought on stage she was positively charming. I thought she was carrying it. Fun show, Hello, Dolly. A couple of other shows to talk about on this program today. Hilary Swank is in a new movie. It's about Alzheimer's and how it affects a family. And it's a really interesting movie. I haven't finished it yet, so I don't have a review for you on it, but it looks good what I've seen. They sent me a screener, and I wasn't able to get through it today. Just moments ago, she and I were talking. I interviewed her a short while ago. And I think, Elif, we're going to play that interview back on Monday's show, because the interview, as so many of mine do when we tape them, went a little bit long. It was kind of funny because I was talking to her about reviews, and I said, do you read reviews? And she said she tries not to. She doesn't. In fact, she doesn't even have a TV. I mean, she's just kind of out of the media loop as much as she can be. Her father, who had lung transplant surgery 5 years ago, moved in with her, but only then did she have a television. She never has had or watched a TV. This is a person who kind of grew up on TV for a lot of us, right? 90210 and stuff like that. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, am I getting all of my stars and TV shows lined up correctly here? But only recently has she acquired a television, doesn't watch it. She says she only watches her movies. She doesn't watch any TV, let alone anything she was ever in. And she only watches movies that she's in because she's afraid somebody's going to ask, what was your favorite scene? And she doesn't want to describe a scene that got cut from the show. So I said to her, well, I'll tell you this. You're reviewed by Michael Phillips in the Chicago Tribune. Do you want me to read to you what she says about that? He says about you. And then there's this pause. And she said, well, I don't know. Should I? Is it good or is it bad? And then she went into this kind of discussion about reviews and reviewers and how hard it is, and you never know what's going on in their head and blah, 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 blah. So I just let that moment pass. And then towards the end of the interview, she said, okay, you've got to tell me. What does he say?
Well, and it's based in Chicago, the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty cool. You saw the trailer, didn't you, V?
Yeah.
And the trailer's pretty good. It's dramatic, you know. I mean, obviously, it's a drama. It's about how Alzheimer's has afflicted this one family. But and it's three generations. It's the mother and the father, and then their adult children, and then the youngest children who are in their teens or 20s. So it lines up like that. And obviously, Hilary Swank and Michael Shannon, her sibling in this movie, are the middle generation. But finally she says, okay, you've got to tell me. And so I told her, and he says nice things about her. He gives it 3 stars. Elif, what's the name of this dang movie? what they had, what they had. So you'll hear that conversation on our show on Monday. Do you guys think that Megyn Kelly should have been fired for what she said on her show, Megyn Today? Megyn Kelly, here's the soundbite if you missed it. Can you play that for us, Producer Elif? So this is Megyn Kelly. She's, what, in the 9 o'clock hour or 10 o'clock hour on NBC? And she, I was always mystified by her coming to NBC to begin with. Maybe you were too. I thought she was terrific on Fox. And remember, she kind of made a name for herself asking the tough questions. She was strident, but she was no Laura Ingraham, right? I mean, she wasn't, I don't think, an ideologue. She wasn't always right-wing. I think she sort of had some...
No, she was a real rising star. I mean, she was...
And she would ask the hard questions to the conservatives, too.
Right.
She would sometimes put their feet to the fire.
Well, Donald Trump famously went after her after a debate. She was the bleeding from wherever woman.
Yeah.
So she, I mean, was really on her way up. It seemed to be at one point. They were going to, you know, I thought they talked about her eventually anchoring the nightly news.
I never understood her leaving Fox News. I thought that's where she lives. She's very attractive, very intelligent, very telegenic. But is she warm and fuzzy? Is she good around a sofa? Is she the kind of person, is she have a Katie Couric bone in her body? I don't think she does. And I think her work since then has proven that out. So here she is. They're talking about Halloween costumes. How could that possibly go wrong?
What is racist? Because truly, you do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface for Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Like, when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character. There was a controversy on The Real Housewives of New York with Luann, as she dresses Diana Ross. And she made her skin look darker than it really is. And people said that that was racist. And I don't know. I thought, like, who doesn't love Diana Ross? She wants to look like Diana Ross for one day. I don't know how, like, that got racist on Halloween.
Don Lemon on CNN later on said, you know what? She and I are the same age, or about 47. He said, never in our lives has blackface been okay. Maybe in our grandparents' lives or our parents' lives. But blackface is not funny. And it's not okay at your fraternity party, and it's not okay today, and it's never been in the last 47 years. Not cool. By the way, I don't know, do black people sometimes do whiteface? Because she was equating those two, and it's okay if there's context, or it's okay if it's a Halloween costume, or it's okay if you're revering a famous person of color. Whew.
I don't think I've ever read about someone dressing in whiteface.
I don't know that's a thing, but I've definitely seen
that. I know blackface is a thing.
You know what that is, and you know that that's not a good idea. So, she gone. I think she is, right, Steve? What is the status of
Megyn Kelly? The widespread reporting was that they were parting ways.
Yeah.
Well, and then she came out with an apology and issued it herself, as opposed to just the network doing it for her. So, I don't know. I thought that her apology was heartfelt. I thought it was a little over the top heartfelt, but it was good.
That's funny because Eric Zorn and the Mincing Rascals, we record a podcast on Thursday. So also just before the show today, we sat down with some of our friends, and Zorn from the Tribune was in there. And
against all odds, it was a good podcast this week.
I was surprised by Eric because he thought her apology was really good, like Violetta. He didn't say over the top, but he thought it was heartfelt and sincere. And I've since heard that it wasn't good enough, that the network or her critics are saying, yeah, that doesn't fix it. That doesn't get it done.
It just seems nowadays you can't, if you make a mistake, there's very little ways to recover. You're either too apologetic, not apologetic enough, or you double down and make it 10 times worse.
Yeah.
Well, the real crime here is if they wanted to get rid of her anyway, and they use this because they're tarring her as a racist for expediency. And I guess her numbers weren't good, right? She was never widely accepted there. You know what I mean? That's a pretty cruel thing to do if that's the case.
And she's very expensive. I think she's the highest paid news position.
I suppose they'd have to eat that contract, though. I mean, I don't know the terms of it, but it seems to me like a lot of these people, if you fire them, you still have to pay out the contract. I don't know exactly how that would work. You know, the thing I said in the Mincing Rascals, and I'll just say it briefly here, is maybe should she be fired because her show just wasn't successful. and this is the straw that broke the camel's back. Or as Steve said, this is very convenient now for the network to say, well, it was that. We didn't make a mistake. She did. But as a person who traffics in conversation and opinion, I hate to see somebody lose their job because of a poorly expressed opinion. Now, if she revealed herself to be a racist, or if she seems so blind to the insensitivity of that, then maybe, yeah, she should lose her job just based on the context of what she said. But it's possible, too, that she was trying to make a point, and we're talking about Halloween costumes, and she said something really stupid. But I think that's sort of the danger and the drama of what we all do. And I hate to see people lose their jobs because of a poorly expressed opinion, particularly when it does not reflect a core belief. So what do we have here, right? And I think what we have is no more Megyn Kelly on NBC. Lorraine wanted to say something, and you're on WGN. Hi, Lorraine. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jen. First of all, I'm not necessarily a fan of Megyn Kelly. I don't know that much about her. I don't, whatever. However, talking about kids' Halloween costumes, what makes blackface any more offensive than kids in the past or now or whatever dressing up as Indians, dressing up as Orientals with the kimonos, dressing up, my kids dressed up as Italian organ grinders, and I'm Italian.
How old are you?
My 70s.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that's part of the problem here.
What? But I don't see what. I mean, it doesn't make these kids racist. It doesn't make the parents racist. It's called a costume.
Yeah. I appreciate the phone call. I'll say this. I'm not sure that people today, do kids go out in kimonos anymore, or do they go out as Indians still? Do we do that, or do we judge those costumes?
You want to know something?
What's
the
that?
Kids at my grandkids' grade schools can't even wear costumes anymore. Everyone is so darn sensitive that the kids they can't wear masks, they can't wear costumes, so they go to school for Halloween with a sweatshirt on or whatever.
All right.
Kids used to dress as hobos. Is that making fun of homeless people?
I'm just making a list as you talk of all of the costumes I don't think you can do anymore, and I don't think any of these pass the muster anymore.
That's exactly it. People are too darn sensitive.
Right. Hey, Lorraine.
We
are done.
All right.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Drive safely, for goodness sakes.
Was she taking a right or a left?
When I hear the turn signal in the background, I'm like, okay, the more emotional you get, I do not want to hear your car crash on my show. You may care to comment on what Lorraine said. The number's 312-981-7200. A couple of phone calls, 72 text messages. John, Megyn Kelly's ratings were low anyway, so NBC was looking for a reason to dump her. She has a history of racially insensitive comments. That from 312. 630 said, hey, John, I'm 66, and it was okay on Halloween. We put burnt cork on our faces, no problem. Somebody else texted me and said, as a white guy, he went as Red Fox from Sanford and Son at a party that was racially mixed, and everybody laughed and patted him on the back, said it was no big deal. Some of you are reminding us that the Wayans brothers had a movie several years ago where they were white chicks. Guys, how about the movie White Girls? Another one of you remembers. We didn't hear whites cry out that it was racist. Let's look at the context. Plenty of you are just tired of seeing Megyn Kelly on TV, though. Let's pick up a couple of phone lines. We'll start with, let's see here. I don't actually want to talk to any of you. Let's go. Derek, this is John. You're on the air. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Okay. If a kid wants to dress up as a white face, black face, depending on what race they are, and they don't know, they're a kid, they probably don't know racism yet. So you tell them you can't do this, are you not teaching them racism? They just want to honor that person.
No,
most likely they want to honor the person that they're dressing up as.
No, you're teaching them respect.
but they don't know the difference. They don't know that they're anything about racism. They honor that person.
Now, I get your point that maybe the kid who wants to dress as an Indian or as an Asian or as a person of race that's not their own, there's no malice in that kid's heart. So I get your point. You don't want to say, hey, your best sweet little intentions here, Johnny or Jeannie, are not good enough. You can't do that. And now you're introducing the world to them, aren't you? But I think that's called parenting.
I think that's what parents call the teaching moment.
Yeah. I'm with you on that, Steve. Derek, we're out of time. Thanks for the phone call. I appreciate you joining us. By the way, 708 said she has said insensitive things in the past. She said that Jesus is white and Santa Claus is white. This is not new turf for her. Yeah, she did that before. What's that?
That's Domati.
What's that?
Domati Pongo texted that in.
Hey, Domati, thank you for that. Yeah, I've seen that before. In fact, I actually saw her. So now they're playing the clip of when she did that. Thank you, Dominator. Where she, and it was before they go to break, she goes, and by the way, kids or folks, and then she just gave it to them. Santa and Jesus are white or something like that. And I'm not sure that history's on her side on that. I don't know.
Well, first, someone has to sit down and have a talk with her about Santa.
And Jesus. Thank you, Steve. John Williams here. It's 1:36. This is WGN. We're listening to the score of The Bride of Frankenstein. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra is actually going to perform this while you watch the movie. Doesn't that sound like fun? Jim Fahey is the director of programming for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. He's in our studio. Jim, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
What fun.
It has been fun. We've been doing a series devoted to film scores since 2004. And so this is an extra added concert we did for Halloween, but it's a program that we did about 10 years ago for our CSO at the Movies series. And it's just an amazing experience to be able to hear the Chicago Symphony Orchestra play this amazing, evocative score by Franz Waxman while you watch this really classic horror film. It is kind of a really, you know, beautiful example of the horror film genre.
I wonder if the music gets lost when you watch the movie on, say, TV or even on the big screen. Do you appreciate, you know, the score? Are you listening that way?
I think there are moments in a film such as Bride where the score becomes a very, very important part of the movie. There's certainly underscored moments where there's dialogue going on, and so those are usually mixed a little bit lower. But to be able to hear the complete score live is one of the, you know, like I said, amazing experiences we have when we've been doing these live film to orchestra projects.
I'm running through my head instances where the music really is a feature in a movie, and a lot of them are John Williams scores.
Yes.
So I'm thinking Jaws. I'm thinking in Alfred Hitchcock movies.
Yes, Bernard Herrmann's scores were a really important part. There's a story that Psycho would not have been Psycho without the Bernard Herrmann score that he wrote. And that, you know, when watching that film and the shower scene in particular, it's a very important part of the
movie. What an exciting part. I mean, if I was a violinist in a major orchestra, I would just click my heels every day that I'm in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra A. But then if I got to do the violin scene in Psycho, I wonder if I'd actually be nervous. Like, you know, do not get nervous. Do not think about it. Don't flub this line. We can't have a bad squeak here. It has to be the perfect squeak. You know what I mean?
Usually what we have to do is keep them from keeping their eye on the screen, which is above them while they're performing, but they do a very good job of it.
Well, that's the task then for the conductor, right?
Yes.
Because we're watching the movie live. I presume the artists actually aren't, right? They're watching the conductor and following
Correct.
Him or her.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the conductor does use a specific copy of the film that includes either a clock or something called streamers and clicks that keeps him synced with the music, gives him kind of some cues in terms of downbeats and tempos, and he's able to then keep sync with the film on the screen.
I had to do a narration once with an orchestra. I don't read music, and there was no film to follow. I was just doing a narration of Casey at the Bat, and there was some music to it, and it was terrifying because there were parts where I needed to be speaking and they needed to be playing a certain part of music, or they needed to be playing a certain part of music and I needed to match my speech to that. And I didn't always hit my marks. You know, I'm sorry for them, but, you know, they can't slow down for me.
You got to keep going.
Yeah. So how do they do that, though? So because if you have a movie, Bride of Frankenstein, it wasn't a silent film, was it?
It was not. No.
I mean, obviously, there's the soundtrack, right? But, I mean, there's dialogue in this movie.
Correct.
So how do you strip the music out and not also strip out the spoken words?
It is a process of scrubbing the soundtrack. It's a very old soundtrack, so it needed to be kind of re-engineered in that way. And in reality, what's happening is that the music is actually still behind the dialogue. You can't hear it, but so the between the lines of the dialogue, the music is scrubbed out, but it's still there in the background, but you really can't hear it.
So there are times then where the orchestra is playing as well as the original score.
Well, you can't really hear it. It's just behind dialogue, so it's very, very hard to hear. And the presence of the orchestra within, you know, our wonderful space, Orchestra Hall, is really kind of commands the evening.
But then in those spaces in between, boy, that's meticulous editing,
yes,
then, isn't it?
A lot of work.
Somebody had to go down in between each phrase or word, drop the music so that it wouldn't compete with the live. And then I presume in more modern films, they must be multi-tracked. You could simply edit out the music track.
Yeah, the process is editing out the music track and in some cases reducing some of the sound effects tracks so that the music can still become the most important part of the presentation.
Do the musicians like this kind of work?
I think they do. They appreciate the scores that these wonderful composers over the years have written. We started the series in order to give people the chance to hear these scores performed live by the Chicago Symphony, and I think our orchestra members have appreciated that. We've had some wonderful, wonderful success with our audiences, and so I think they appreciate that as well.
Yeah, I don't know how you or they would react to this, but I know that someone once said that one of the great things about cartoons years ago was that when you're watching Bugs Bunny or something like that, a lot of times the madcap scenes were set to classical music.
Correct.
It was an introduction. It was the entree for a lot of us into that kind of sound.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we haven't done it with the Chicago Symphony, but there is a program called Bugs Bunny on Broadway that brings all of those scores to life, too. So we're talking about maybe bringing that back in the future.
So the great then, so when you scout these movies then, you must be thinking not great movie, but great score in a movie. And
that's
then does the movie
challenge.
Hold up?
That is the challenge, yes, because there's more and more titles now becoming available that are really wonderful movies. But I think for the most part, they're scores that, you know, were written by amazing composers, but might not be as memorable as some of the more classic films and more famous scores that we know of.
Right, and the CSO doesn't want to just show a movie,
correct,
right, and then be the background music. They want to be feature players in the film. So this one works, Bride of Frankenstein. By the way, Bride of Frankenstein, Chicago Symphony Orchestra Hall, Friday, October 26th at 7:30 p.m. Friday, October 26th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are still available, and you can get them right now by going to CSO.org. What a fun thing to do on Halloween weekend, huh? CSO.org.
I think we made it a little bit more fun because we're also showing Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein immediately following without the orchestra, but to hear those or see those two films back to back is really kind of an amazing experience.
A double feature,
as
it were.
Exactly.
Yeah, good for you guys. Well, but what are some of the other movies in the series then?
This season we'll be presenting The Empire Strikes Back, John Williams' amazing score to that film in Thanksgiving weekend, I should say. We're also going to be presenting North by Northwest, the great Alfred Hitchcock thriller with the Bernard Herrmann score.
Do I know? I mean, will I recognize that score?
I think there's parts, especially in the opening sequence, that it's very, very, very evocative of that film. So, yes, I think so.
Okay, keep going. You got to North by Northwest.
And then we end the series this year with American in Paris. So Gershwin's score with this amazing film that will use all that wonderful music from Gershwin.
Do people do, boy, how much fun will American in Paris be?
It should be wonderful.
Oh, no kidding. Do people do this too, or is this tempting then? They'll come up and say, okay, I love this movie. You guys have to do Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Burt Bacharach, it's lovely. Let's do that one. What do you say?
How about this film? How about that film?
But that's okay, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't make a squishy face at Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, although I don't know that that lends itself to what you all do. Although you did make a squishy face when I said, how about the theme song from Gidget before we went on the air? And you said the CSO is not doing TV show theme songs.
Yet.
Actually, this is a different conversation, but I think when you go back and listen to some of those old TV show theme songs, they're nice little ditties.
They are.
Some of them are nice little two-minute songs. I think that art is a little lost these days, or at least not appreciated if it's still out there. This texter says, John, I enjoyed the CSO performance during the ET presentation. I waited to see how things would hold up during the BMX chase scene, when the bicycle rides off into the moon in the movie, and it was unbelievable. That's nice to hear.
It is. I'm glad that people have that experience, because the music is such an important part of those films, and to hear it live performed by our great orchestra is special.
Yeah, and again, I'm not a musician, never have been, but I would be nervous about either the syncing of it or the expectation that the audience has. I think if a lot of us go see a symphony orchestra, we don't know the music that well, and we wouldn't notice if it wasn't the way we wanted it to be or the way it's most frequently done. But here there's an expectation. We know how the ET theme goes. We know the Psycho scene, you know? So I wonder if the director or the players feel like they're a little confined because they can't, there's no interpretation of this. You have to do it true to the film.
Right. I'm sure that their enjoyment level, as it were, of performing a Bruckner symphony like they're doing this week is on a different level from what they will face, you know, tomorrow night when they are confined in some ways to following and being synced to a film. But I think that they have expressed a like of this genre and these audiences and this idea. So I think they find pleasure in both types of music making.
Well, I suppose the thought process has to be, too, that if they do this, now maybe they're, hey, what do you know? The CSO isn't so scary or stuffy after all. I'm going to check out one of their non-film performances as well. Are you able to buy tickets just to the movie series, or how does that work?
Certainly, there's a subscription package actually available for the movie series, those three films. But we also have plenty of single tickets available for repeat performances of the films that aren't on the subscription series and the other film offerings that we have.
You doing Harry Potter?
We're doing a couple of Harry Potter films. Yes, the Harry Potter 2, the Chamber of Secrets, in December, and we're just about to announce Harry Potter 3, Prisoner of Azkaban, which will be performed in June.
But I reckon, yeah, no kidding. Here again, though, so then we're all thinking, okay, you got to do this movie, you got to do that movie. But that's the challenge for Jim Fahey, is the director of programming for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So one more time, if you want to get tickets to the show, is it only showing once then, Friday, October 26th, The Bride of Frankenstein? That's the one showing of that at 7:30 p.m.
Correct.
So get tickets to that as well as to the rest of these. And all of the details are at cso.org. If you want to call, here's the phone number. It's 1-800-223-7114. 1-800-223-7114 or 312-294-3000. Maybe cso.org is the easiest way to get started. Orchestra Hall, of course, I was about to say on Michigan Avenue.
Correct.
It is on Michigan Avenue, 220 South Michigan Ave, Symphony Center.
Correct.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in. Congratulations in advance on what I'm sure will be a terrific performance. What a great selection of movies, and how appropriate for Halloween week, The Bride of Frankenstein. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
It's 1:49. This is WGN. In the next hour, we'll talk a little bit about that caravan of people coming through South America. From South America through Mexico. Were they even in South America, or were they always in Central America? Guatemala to the United States. Was it yesterday, the day before, they said these people have still to go the equivalent of walking from Miami to Washington, D.C. Imagine that in flip-flops, maybe carrying your kid or holding their hand in 90-degree heat. Good grief. You know, 20, 25 miles a day. It's unbelievable.
Steve Cochran said something this week that stuck with me, and he said, yes, and so we're to believe that terrorists who want to sneak into the country are marching all 3,000 miles with them rather than, you know, just flying up to the border and coming in that way.
I was so disappointed in the vice president because he said, well, almost surely there are some dangerous Middle Easterners embedded in there. I don't watch Fox News a lot. I look at their website just about every day. If they've posted the pictures of those people, I've missed it. But you'd think they would kind of stand out. I mean, if they're there, you know, there's 7,000 of these migrants working their way through Mexico, and there's 8,000 journalists covering this. So you'd think that somebody would have found this cell of bad dudes that are walking through Mexico on their way to the U.S. And then when they get here, what exactly happens? And, you know, I think this is where the conversation gets a little lost, because those of us who are, as I am now, expressing sympathy or amazement for these people, I don't think are all saying, and then let them in. I'm surely not. I'm very curious about the process here. When I see that mass of people walking north, you know what I think of is what a bureaucratic nightmare this is. 7,000 people, probably fewer because so many of them typically drop out. But a bunch of people are going to show up at a bunch of places, and somebody's got to figure out what to do with this. Now, some of them may scamper across the river and sneak in, but that's not really how this thing usually goes. They are processed. So there's that. I see a giant 7,000-person mob of bureaucracy. Somebody's headache is coming to America. And then I also see just the humanity. I'm amazed at what these people are going through. I am not one to say, well, boy, if they can get up there, we just ought to let them in. At least not because of the fact that they've endured an arduous journey. There is a process. Our guest in the next hour has worked with people who have made that trip. Also in the next hour, we talked to George Saunders. He wrote The Very Persistent Gappers of Fripp, and he wrote Lincoln and the Bardo. And he famously gave a speech to Syracuse University graduates in 2013 about the lost opportunities for kindness. And he said in this speech that there are some things that he regrets in life and some things that he does not regret. He started his speech by saying, among the things I don't regret.
So, what do I regret? Being poor from time to time? Not really. Skinny dipping in a river in Sumatra? A little buzzed. And looking up and seeing like 300 monkeys sitting on a pipeline, pooping down into the river. The river in which I was swimming. With my mouth open, naked, and getting deathly ill afterwards and staying sick for the next 7 months. Not so much.
Doesn't regret that. Life's an adventure, right? So cut to Elif. He does talk about what he does regret, though.
What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was right there in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. Or to look at it from the other end of the telescope, who in your life do you remember most fondly, with the most undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were kindest to you, I bet. It's a little facile maybe, and certainly hard to implement, but I'd say as a goal in life, you could do worse than try to be kinder.
Not bad, huh? The whole speech goes about 12 minutes. If you got a Google, I would just type in George Saunders' Syracuse speech, and you will be glad that you did. News is coming up next. This is WGN Radio. Steve Bertrand will have it live from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I do.
Here's John Williams.
Doesn't mean you're going to like him, though. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're downtown Chicago weekdays until 3.
Lord have mercy.
And on Saturdays from 10 a.m. till noon on social media, it's WGN King John. By the way, producer Elif, have we launched today's news click? Let's find out what we're going to do. with the News Click. It's a daily web poll question. We do have the News Click up, correct? Can you tell us, Producer Elif, what the new News Click is? Or do we not know yet? Did we not put it up yet? It's not up yet? All right, when it's up, let me know, and then we'll go ahead and share it with the whole class. Yesterday, we asked you bombs sent to CNN and other political figures. You had two options about how you felt about that. And 74% of you, the vast majority, said this is a sign that everyone needs to turn the rhetoric down. Another major story that, of course, has been working its way through the news is this group of 7,000 people walking through Mexico, heading north to the United States, that famous caravan. Karen Zwick is in our studio. She's an associate director of litigation at the National Immigration Justice Center, or Immigrant Justice Center, and oversees LGBT immigrant rights issues. I guess not exclusively that, though, but welcome to the studio. Hi, Karen. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We spoke with one of your colleagues a couple of times before when we were talking about the separation of some of these families, the kids separated from the families, and some of them actually put in the Chicago area. Are some of those kids still in the Chicago area, by the way?
They are, yes. In fact, we are representing a child who is separated from his mother. He's four, she's in Texas, and he is here.
Why are they not been reunited?
According to the United States government, the mom was a drug dealer. We've since proven that she is not a drug dealer, and in fact that she was coming to the United States fleeing, but they refused to reunite them on the basis of that.
Is there a certain, I don't know, everybody maybe has an opinion about a particular case. You sort of get the feeling that y'all dig your heels in, that they don't want to see it your way because the administration's position on this issue is different than yours. So I wonder if that just makes the sort of fact gathering and, you know, the sorts of, you know, things that we ought to be able to figure out with evidence more difficult to do because as an issue, the two sides are in different places as well. It's not like we're all in the room trying to figure it out. We're trying to figure it out from different perspectives.
Sure. It for sure makes a difference in terms of how we go about it. And it also is frustrating because it takes away from the humanity of the whole situation. Let's keep in mind that in that case in particular, there's a four-year-old who has been separated from his mother for months. He's losing the ability to speak. He's no longer potty trained, things that he was fine with when he got here. And because of the separation and because of his inability to see his mother, he is suffering egregious harm.
He has no idea why he's separated, or it must make no sense to a four-year-old. It doesn't make any sense to anybody.
I mean, one can only imagine because he can't speak now, so we can't even really ask him what he is thinking, because where he could speak before, he can't now.
These groups of people that move through, I call it a caravan. Everybody calls it a caravan. Are you comfortable with that word or phrase?
Sure. I think it's an okay phrase. I think it's important, though, to know that groups of migrants have traveled to the United States as groups forever, and this is not a new thing. So giving it a name makes it sound like it's new when it's not really.
But I've not followed this kind of a thing before. Only in the last year or so have I heard about the caravans. The president has shined a light on it, and he's worried about that. A lot of people are. But this has been going on for a while.
Right. Migrants have been coming to the United States in groups forever. I think the thing that's new is that because of the extreme danger that exists in Central America and in Mexico for people who are traveling, trying to make their way to the United States, groups have formed a strategy of sort of banding together to sort of pool their resources and to protect one another. That is a new strategy that seems to have picked up a little bit more forcefully.
Are these mostly people that live south of Mexico, or is it a mixture of, say, Guatemalans and Mexicans?
The vast majority of people who are traveling here are Central Americans, so Hondurans, from El Salvador, and also Guatemala. There are some Mexicans in the group, too.
Yeah. So, 7,000, has it been that big a group in the past?
I don't think that we have real security that the number in this group is 7,000, and certainly the groups in the past have been smaller. But I do want to sort of back up, take a step back, and remind your listeners that migration to the United States is at historic lows in recent years, and even though it seems like 7,000 is a really large number, historically in the fall season, there's a little bit of a spike before it gets cold, and then it goes dramatically down.
So is it organized by somebody? I mean, I understand the sort of safety in numbers, but it almost looks like there was some organization to it.
I don't think that we have enough evidence to know that there was organization, for example, in Honduras to sort of gather people together before they left. what I think happens is that people sort of join the group as it's traveling.
So it's getting bigger as it goes, maybe.
It gets bigger as it goes until it gets to somewhere around Mexico City, and then it starts to shrink.
That's
my experience.
Because why?
Because people drop off. They get scared of, they know that they're going to be detained and put in a jail
or
in the United States.
Or maybe just the physical nature of it?
Or it's too arduous of a journey, or they decide that they feel okay to stay in Mexico.
You have worked with people from these kinds of groups in the past?
Yeah, I have. I've worked with clients. As a lawyer, I've represented clients from two different caravans in the past.
Huh. Last year and the year before.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Who's feeding them along the way?
Mostly they're beneficiaries of the kindness of strangers along the way. They're also suffering from violence along the way, too. There are people who, the group that was in Mexico last year, they were attacked in their one of the shelters that was set up for them.
Where do they sleep at night?
Wherever they can. Sometimes in homes, sometimes on the streets, often in the streets. And I think that's a big reason for why they travel in groups.
TV reporting I see shows them getting water and food from locals when they come to town, like the Tour de France or something. Everybody shows up, and not like that, but it comes to your town. It's an event for a day or so, and the people hand them food, and then off they go. Is it kind of like that?
I mean, I think to a certain degree, yes, because for most of humanity, I think we can all agree that if you see starving kids or young kids who are hungry and who have been walking for 25 miles, your instinct is to give them a little of what you can.
And so are the Mexican people okay with this? I mean, is there an attitude about this thing?
My personal sense is that I think there's some resignation that migration to the United States through Mexico has been a thing forever, and that people know that it's a thing that exists, especially for people who are coming to seek asylum or who are seeking protection. They need to seek protection in a place where they feel safe. And if that place isn't Mexico, then let's send them on. I think the Mexican attitude is let's send them on to where they want to go.
A lot of people think like this. I'll just read you a text that just came in that says, who's paying for these caravans? Not the 7,000 people deciding to say, let's start walking. It's organized by a globalized effort, which happens all over. A sympathetic part is the children. It's not their fault, but people think this is almost a Trojan horse, or it's a political tool. Now, what do you think of that?
The person who wrote that message seems to think that there's some kind of rich billionaire funding these groups, and that's certainly not true. They are indigent and impoverished, and there are people who are in the United States who are sending money to certain groups and in the amounts of like $25 at a time that's funding this work. And as to the political side of this, I think it's unfortunate, really, that the humanity of these folks are being lost because of the political climate around immigration in this country. Because these people are coming here, they're fleeing violence in their country, especially those who are coming from Honduras, which has the highest murder rate in the world, and also very little infrastructure in their country. So when you're fleeing that reality in search of safety, freedom, and security, I wish that that's what the conversation was about, and not about
The politics. I don't want to talk about the politics that much either. But if I had to handicap it, my own view of what's happening in America right now is that this is to the advantage of the president or to the people that are sympathetic to the president's views on this. This is a very powerful image. It's an image of what the president has been warning us about all along. I mean, you worry about immigration, but where are they? There they are. It's this 7,000 person throng. So to me, the people that who want to make this an issue or who want to define this issue some way, they've got pictures of it on TV every day right now.
Yeah, and I can understand why people are scared. But it's important to remember that the economics of migration first of all, it's important to remember that migration is at a historic lows right now. And these numbers, though they seem large, are actually lower than most migration in most of our lives.
So what happens when they get to the United States border?
For the most part, they go to jail. They come to the United States border. They ask for asylum. They present themselves at a bridge or at a crossing gate. They ask for asylum. They're detained. They are detained for the duration of their asylum process, which, if they're successful, could last 5 or 6 months. And then if they are granted asylum, which is a two-part process that is very arduous and requires a lot of proof, they are released into the United States as asylees, as refugees. If they're denied, they're deported back to their home country without ever setting foot in the United States outside of the jail.
What percentage in your experience, you've represented clients, you say, in the last 2 years? You use the word clients. They don't pay you for this service, do they?
That's right. We do our work for free.
You've represented people, though, in the last couple of years in these caravans. What's the percentage of them that are successful, that get asylee status?
It's hard to know as a general matter. I think there are viable asylum claims from all of these countries. The clients that I work with in particular are members of the LGBT community who are seeking asylum based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity. And those cases are fairly often successful because the country conditions in those countries are so atrocious.
So, but you do have to make their case then to a judge. Say it was because of their orientation or their identity, but say it's just because of violence. Do they have to prove to somebody that they were personally victims of violence in Guatemala and therefore should be given status in the United States?
Right. It's no easy matter to win an asylum case. You have to show harm that's very severe, like persecution, not just generalized economic harm.
How do you do that?
Through your own testimony, through testimony of your family, people who left behind, through evidence, like sometimes people have newspaper articles, sometimes people have scars that they can have a doctor.
So you take all this information and present it then, or somebody right. on their behalf does, to a judge?
Ideally somebody on their behalf, but because immigrants in the United States don't have a right to appointed counsel, many of them have to do this on their own.
Does the judge speak Spanish?
Oh, no.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. So they are, in their best English, going to make their case.
When they finally get to a judge, they have an interpreter who speaks to the judge for them. But in the preparation process, they don't often have access to any English language services.
Steve, you were going to ask a question, too. I don't mean to get in the way here. Mr. Bertrand?
I'm sorry. I was listening with half an ear, John. But when you were talking about the process where they come to the border, they apply, and then you said they're detained, right? And I don't know if you covered that, but in the past, this is where that family separation kicked in. Am I correct or am I incorrect?
You're correct that family separation is a part of the overall detention mechanism in the United States. The United States government detains about 40,000 migrants every single day, and they're in county jails and big private prisons. That's where they are.
40,000 immigrants in the United States on any given day.
Yeah, per day.
Are not 40,000 new ones every day, but 40,000 in total.
That's right.
Are being held in jails.
That's right.
Usually along the border, I guess. But
a lot of them are along the border, but we have several in the Midwest, including some in central Illinois and in Indiana.
We'll pick that up here in a minute. Because I'm still, to me, the question is, none of this matters to any of us. Right? This is a problem for these individuals. It's a problem maybe for Mexico or the people in those towns. It's not a problem for us until they get to the border and then do or don't come into the United States. So that to me is where our focus should be. I mean, the humanity notwithstanding, if your concern is we can't let them in, then I want to know more about that. You do too. The number is 312-981-7200. That's the number you're calling and texting to, and we'll pick it up here in a minute. Lots of texts and some calls about this. Karen, where did the foreign aid go that we sent to these countries? Corruption within exists, and that's sad. A comment on that?
Yes, the corruption within the governments in Central America is profoundly sad, and what's going on with aid that we send is also sad. It's the geopolitical circumstances of what's going on in Central America is far beyond the scope of what we have time for in this hour, but cutting off the aid certainly isn't going to solve this problem.
No one is fleeing. 7,000 people. This is funded by our enemies, John.
People are fleeing. That's just not true. I know people personally who have fled.
How about this? Lies, lies, lies. What about the trucks and the buses? Who's paying for the trucks and buses that are helping these people?
The owners of those trucks and buses are paying for the trucks and the buses.
John, I thought violence was not a reason for asylum. You can't say it's violence in my country, and then I get to come into yours. Is that true?
generalized violence, if it's not severe enough and it's not for based on a protected group, membership in a protected group is not a basis for asylum. But if you are an indigenous Guatemalan, or if you're an LGBT person, or if you are someone with a disability, for example, maybe you are a member of a protected group and you do qualify for asylum.
But if I live in El Salvador and bullets are flying everywhere and members of my family are killed, then I might be next, and I'm not a drug dealer, I'm just a guy trying to live. I can't knock on the door of the United States and say, it's crappy here, would you let me in? I'm seeking asylum based on violence. That's not cause per se.
You can knock on the door because everybody has, the United States is legally bound to allow people who come to this country to seek asylum. You might not get it, but you should be allowed to seek it, which is what efforts to shut the border or close our border would cut off, is our legal obligation to allow these people the chance to ask.
What can we do to help you guys?
To help the National Immigrant Justice Center, if you are a lawyer and you want to get involved, you can become a pro bono attorney with us if you want to do that. If you are somebody who wants to sort of tell the story of immigrants, you should have these uncomfortable conversations with your family and friends.
Karen Zwick at the Illinois, well, the office of it, actually that's where it's headquartered, right? The National Immigrant Justice Center here in Chicago. What's the website, by the way?
www.immigrantjustice.org.
Thanks for coming in, Karen. Do join us again.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have my copy of Lincoln and the Bardo?
No, I do not.
You think
I'd return books that I borrow?
No, I had it here today. We recorded books. The Missing Rascals in this studio. I had it then, and now I can't find it.
Well, it'd be embarrassing if you had a prominent author like George Saunders around and not the book. That's wow. That's
Mr. Saunders. I just want to begin this interview with an apology, sir. Because I put all my notes in the flap of the book or on the back page, and I can't find my copy. You don't know where it is, do you, George?
No, I've got it memorized, so I don't need it.
Do you have his notes memorized?
I can pretty much, yeah.
Because it was page 71 or page 72 where I went, okay, now I'm getting it.
It was 71.
I'm not kidding, though. George Saunders is on a phone line. The Chicago Tribune's Heartland Literary Award this year for fiction is going to be presented to you, sir, for Lincoln in the Bardo. You'll accept the award and discuss the work with the Tribune Books editor Jennifer Day on stage at the Chicago Humanities Festival at Symphony Center. That's going to be at 3 o'clock October 27th. So congratulations. What a great achievement. You must be proud.
Yeah, especially, you know, it's so nice to be honored in your hometown. So I'm really excited to come back and accept that award for sure.
You know who I bumped into in the hall today was Bill Leff. And he goes, John, I went to school with George Saunders. I think grade school, maybe.
Yeah, back out in Oak Forest. That's right.
Do you remember Bill? Was he a good student? Was he kind of a pain in the butt? What was he like?
No, he was a great guy. Great guy. Not a pain in the butt at all. When, you know, the thing about him was whenever he had notes, he would always have them with him. He never would leave a book behind or anything.
Okay, that's really funny. By the way, Bill was really funny. I mean, he is really funny now. I wonder if he was really funny as a kid in school. And were you a really good writer? Here you are, this literary light in America. Did that shine in eighth grade? Did all of your teachers go, hokey smokes, we've got a New York Times best-selling author right here?
Not a bit. No, kind of the opposite. I had one really amazing reading experience in third grade where this nun at St. Damien's named Sister Lynette, who I was kind of in love with, gave me a copy of that book, Johnny Tremaine. And she did this really cool thing. Any of your Catholic listeners will understand. She said, some of the other sisters and I were talking about you in the convent. And I was like, oh, my God, you talk about me in the convent? And she just said, we think this is a really hard book, but we think you can handle it. So she gave me this book, and that was kind of the big reading experience of my childhood. But mostly I was playing in bands or trying to play baseball and wasn't that good of a writer or that big of a reader, weirdly.
When did the switch flip? When did you start to get the hang of it, if you will?
Well, you know, I went after college, or after high school, rather, a couple of teachers got me into the Colorado school of mine, this engineering school, Joe and Sherry Lindblom. So I studied engineering for 4 or 5 years and went to Asia. And that's when it really hit me that I was only going to ever be a kind of a, you know, mediocre engineer. But reading and writing just really always lit me up. So I started to make the transition at about 24, 25, and got sick in Asia and then came home, and that was when the way kind of suddenly became clear, and I thought, I'm never going to really be entirely happy unless I'm trying to write a book.
Was the sickness you're referring to in Asia where you were swimming in the river and the monkeys were pooping in the water?
Yes, yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I was swimming and had a few drinks maybe, and I looked over and there was a pipeline, an oil pipeline, and about 300 monkeys on it, all pooping down in the water. And I kind of thought, oh, I wonder if that's okay. And it wasn't. And struggled for about 2 years after that to kind of get my health back.
Isn't that amazing? Wow.
Yeah.
And by the way, not to dwell on that story, but I will just for a second, because you famously referred to that in your 2013, I think it was, graduation speech to the parents and graduates at Syracuse, where you still teach. And that speech has now been viewed 87 zillion times, including once by me again today. And boy, if ever there was a time for a message that talked about the virtue of kindness, it's right now. Thank you for making that speech.
Oh, thank you for mentioning it. Yeah, I it was one of those things where I had been asked to give this talk, and about 3 days before, I went to find this speech I'd written about kindness years before, and I couldn't. So I had to kind of quickly write it. And, really, I think my feeling now is that we have a greater capacity for kindness than we show publicly a lot of times on the internet or on TV. And all of us, we live by kindness. I mean, everything that you do, whether you're talking to your kids or going to the airport or trying to do something at a PTA meeting, we kind of know that kindness and empathy are really useful, and they're really high order human things. But somehow I think especially in the media landscape, we forget that. So it's like it's like oxygen to us to be thoughtful of other people and to sort of assume the best of them. And at certain stress moments, we forget that, and it's always to our detriment.
2018 Chicago Tribune Heartland Literary Award winner George Saunders on a phone line. He's a Chicago area kid, and they're awarding you evidently for Lincoln and the Bardo. I presume, though, it also includes the body of work that you did. One of my favorite books I've ever read, and I forgot that you wrote it, was The Very Persistent Gappers of Fripp. My sons and I so enjoyed that story.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Thank you. I actually wrote that for my daughters back when they were little. I would kind of tell them a story every night, and that one in particular seemed better than the others, so I wrote it up to kind of, commemorate those very beautiful evenings of storytelling with them.
When you were telling that story to your daughters, were you just kind of making it up as you go? Were you writing it at the time? How does that go?
No, I would just, go in at night and improvise a story for them. And it was kind of a great thing because, when you have your kids, your little beloved kids there, and you're trying to keep them interested, you can always tell when you're failing, when they get restless or they just go to sleep. So it was kind of, I just improvised it. And at the time, they were, they're girls, they're daughters, and they were young. And I was just starting to kind of wake up from a lifetime of sort of like mild, misogyny, just that kind of slight bit of misogyny that I think all of us in our generation had. And so the stories I was telling tended to be about young girl characters who were heroic in a kind of a particularly feminine way. They weren't necessarily beating anybody up, but they were kind of outwitting their enemies and also sometimes just transforming their enemies through, as we were saying, kindness, So it was kind of a great opportunity to have a live audience and that you loved, and to see if you could keep them compelled.
Yeah, but I just wonder if they look up from the pillow and go, Dad, are you focus grouping us? Because
yeah.
If you're making notes going, okay, yes, they responded to that positively.
I have to go type something up and call my agent.
Well, so for those who don't know that story, and then we'll go on to Lincoln and the Bardo real quick, but just what is that story about?
Well, it's basically it's a young girl, kind of a lonely kid, and she lives in this weird community where they raise goats. But every night, this sort of tidal wave of these little creatures called gappers takes over the whole town. And so, the kids in that community have been charged with basically clearing those things out, several times a day. So, it kind of became a story about the tendency we all have to assume that if we have good luck, we must have 100% caused it. And if you have bad luck, it's because of some flaw in your character, And we all know from our lives that it doesn't work that neatly, Sometimes you can do your best and have bad luck and so on. So it's kind of, it ended up for me being a little bit of a callback to my Catholic childhood where, we were taught that you love each other regardless of the circumstance, and that you see bad luck as part of what we're called upon to understand, you know, to not judge somebody because they're poor or because they're having trouble, but to see the sort of inner God, you know, or the Christ inside that person. So for me, it actually became almost like a little bit of a religious story. And so
are you a religious person, George?
Yeah, I was raised Catholic in Chicago and had a beautiful experiences. And then my wife and I have transitioned over into Tibetan Buddhism, which actually for me is very similar to Catholicism in a lot of important ways. So, yeah, and I think writing for me is kind of part of that, you know, just to sort of make up some people, try to make them come to life, and then watch what they do in this kind of exaggerated scale model of life. And then from that, I often get insights into how I'd like to behave, and you know how we might live a little more compassionately, and so on. So I think of it as kind of a scale model of life that you make with your own concentration.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting about you, comma, is that you seem like we're having a swell conversation here, using whole sentences. It seems to be pretty normal. A lot of your writing is not. Like, I didn't know what you were going to be like, because Lincoln and the Bardo almost defies description. That's such an odd story and such an odd way to tell that story.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's almost like, I suppose, a musician. You know, like a musician should be able to go to the store and have a functional conversation and so on. And then that person kind of lives for that 2 or 3 hours a day when they can really go out on a limb. For me, the weirdness in a story or the darkness or whatever, it's always to try to get at some deeper truth. You know, we go around in our lives thinking and speaking in a pretty normal way because that's how we do business and that's how we function. But yeah, Deep down, we know there's some sometimes pretty scary truths floating around about mortality and about our own limitations. So for me, writing is kind of a chance to get at those deeper truths. And sometimes to do that, you got to kind of use extraordinary measures. You know, the normal language and the normal forms might not get you as deep as you want to go.
So how do you describe this book, Lincoln and the Bardo?
You know, I've been trying for like 2 years to get a pithy description.
I know everybody could just read it, but the elevator speech on this must be impossible.
It is. It is. I mean, basically, what happened was about 20 years ago, my wife and I were in D.C., and we drove by Oak Hill Cemetery, and my wife's cousin pointed out this really cool-looking crypt up on a hill, and she said, "Did you know that Abraham Lincoln's son, Willie, who died at 11, was briefly buried in there?" And not only that, but Lincoln went in there on several occasions, according to the newspapers, and somehow interacted with the body. So that was, I mean, I found that idea so weird and beautiful and sad. So that was really, the whole book is just trying to dramatize that night. And then all the weird things, the formal things, and the kind of strange appearance on the page, mostly was just my attempt to do that idea without sucking, you know, like to not make it too much of a standard historical book, to try to really get at the beauty and the sadness of that moment. And sometimes what you have to do is you have to, you know, kind of mess around with the form in order to make it new. So that's kind of what it was. But mostly, really, it's a love story. You know, it's a father who loses his son and isn't ready to say goodbye. And like any of us, you know, he can't believe that this has actually happened. And it kind of, for me, was about that notion that, you know, we're in this world and we feel from the minute we're born that we're here forever, and we fall in love with people and with the world, and we make these beautiful connections. And then all along, there's been this parallel truth, which is that our sense of permanence isn't real, you know. And I don't have any answer for that. It's so shocking and
right,
so kind of disappointing. So the book was kind of just a meditation on that, you know, that tried to be funny just so it was bearable.
Well, meditation's maybe a right word, because without any explanation, what you do then is give voice to all of the ghosts in that graveyard. And then you also give voice to some historians. Doris Kearns Goodwin makes a brief appearance in a couple of paragraphs in your book. But then, and the book is told short paragraph by short paragraph. Some pages might have only 50 words on them, and it's all of these people just talking and talking and talking, and there's no overarching narrator saying, okay, everybody, now we're going to go over here. You just kind of have to get on this bus and ride it for a while and figure out who's on it and what's going on. True. Fair enough.
It's really just a series of monologues. That's actually a great description. I wish I'd written that down. I'll use that for the elevator pitch. But you know, my thought is, you know, at this stage of life, I'm like, well, if you go into a room of 200 people, let's say you go into an auditorium or a mall or whatever, or you're on an airplane, what's the God's eye view of that situation? And to me, it seems like it's basically 200 inner monologues going crazy, you know, 200 consciousnesses firing away nonstop. And that's basically it. You know, and all of our human drama comes out of the fact that my internal monologue and yours might come into conflict. So when I think about writing these bigger books, I'm like, well, how can I avoid BS? You know, how can I avoid lying about our condition here? And I always have kind of felt that that third-person narrator, that kind of bossy, omniscient narrator who tells you what's true, is a little bit of a falsification. Now, some people, of course, do it so beautifully that it's not. But for me, I love the idea of just letting people talk.
I know that, but pardon me for cutting you off. But I mean, so that's the luxury of the writer. But did you worry that the reader might go, "What the hell's happened? What is this?" You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. And you know, anecdotally, about 30% of them do. There's a moment in the book, usually about page 30, where people would either throw it across the room or, you know, write me an angry email. But my thought was never to be difficult or be elusive, but kind of to say, all right, if you'll bear with me in learning this new form,
right.
The book's going to teach you, then I'm hoping there's a big payoff at the end.
Okay,
that's the kind of bargain I make. Some people don't make it past that point, but it's almost like if you listen to the Miles Davis, The Kind of Blue, you know, the first 5 minutes you're like, huh, I wonder why this is great. And then my theory is he's kind of teaching you how to hear that album, and by the end of it, it's doing things that you didn't know that music could do. So it's sort of an act of faith between the reader and me. I'm saying, I know this is a little hard right now. Please bear with me. I promise by page 300 you're going to be with me. You know?
Well, the turning point for me was not page 70 or 71, as I said. My producer, Olive, just walked in with the book a minute ago, and it's on page 69. Give me credit. It was close. And there's maybe two sentences in there, and I almost cried. Maybe I did a little bit, and I thought, oh, my God, I guess I'm still here, and I'm getting it, and it's impactful. Let me share with you that sentence in a minute. George Saunders is on a line. He's in town in a weekend. He's receiving an award from the Tribune. Lincoln and the Bardo, the novel, is the one that they are giving him their Heartland what is it exactly called? The Heartland Literary Award for Fiction. Lincoln in the Bardo is the book that I've got in my hand. Thank you, Ella, for tracking it down for me. The author is George Saunders, and he's going to be in town at Symphony Center October 27th at 3 p.m. The Tribune's book editor, Jennifer Day, is going to interview him on stage, and they'll talk about the book for which he is receiving the Tribune's Heartland Literary Award for Fiction 2018. Lincoln and the Bardo has been out for a while, and some of us have been reading the book. My son has forever, George Saunders, been telling me, you got to read this book, Dad. You got to read this book. I like that the kid is now telling the adult to read the book. You know what I mean?
Yeah, tell him thanks for me.
Yeah, no kidding. And then, have they made this into a movie? Can they make this into a movie?
We're trying to, yeah. I'm just about to start writing the script, and we got some pretty cool ideas. And, it's going to be a real stretch, but I think we can do it.
Page 69, a couple of ghosts are talking about Willie Lincoln, who's passed away. He's there in my mind somewhere underground floating around with these ghosts, or maybe it's above ground and they're in the graveyard. But one says to the other, that kind of touching. No one wants that. A bunch of voices are saying these. But this was different. The holding, the lingering, the kinds of words whispered directly into the ear. My God, my God. Another voice says, to be touched so lovingly, so fondly, as if one were still. And then Hans Volman says, healthy. And it's the description of these ghosts watching Abraham Lincoln, I presume, touching Willie, and how moved they are by this man's sorrow. That's the scene, right?
Yeah, that's it. You got it.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, George.
thank you for going that far, and hope you'll finish it.
I know you know the line, but I wanted our audience to hear it, and I know that they so appreciate it, those who have read it, and if you haven't, Lincoln and the Bardo, the Tribune says, is the best book for fiction this year. Congratulations. Welcome back to Chicago when you get into town, and hopefully if I get lucky someday, you'll come into our studio and say hi too, George.
I would love to do that. You're an amazing interviewer.
Stay well, and thank you for writing.